Thank you for joining us at our off-site court here at the University of Akron. We're here to acknowledge the 100th anniversary of the law school, and it is an honor for us to be here for both today, this session, and the next session, which will take place tomorrow. We have 12 schools that are represented, and we'll be participating in our, participating by viewing our oral argument. This is the 78th session of Off-Site Court. We have been doing this for 34 years. It is a key part of the Supreme Court of Ohio's expanding civic education program. By traveling around the state, we wish to provide students, teachers, and community members the experience of an in-person session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. After all, for American democracy to function properly, our citizens must understand how our institutions of government work. For the judiciary, this mission of education is especially critical. Ohioans have a responsibility to educate themselves about our democratic institutions. Because of COVID, we haven't heard cases on the road since 2019 when we were in Williams County. Now we're back, and this spring we plan to visit Fayette County in South Central Ohio. High school auditoriums and college halls like this are great venues for seeing and hearing the cases that come before us. So I would like to thank our university hosts for inviting us here and making us part of the observance of this law school's 100th anniversary. I'd also like to thank all who organized our sessions, the president of the University of Akron, Dr. Gary Miller, Akron Law School Dean Christopher Peters and Assistant Dean Charles Oldfield, Summit County Common Pleas Presiding Judge Eleanor Marsh Stormer, Summit County Common Pleas Administrative Judge Amy Corrigal Jones, Common Pleas Judge Allison Brough, and the Akron Bar Executive Director C. Allen Nichols. Appreciation is also in order to the superintendents, the principals, and the staff from the 12 Akron and Summit County high schools for taking part today and tomorrow. The visiting high schools are Akron Buchtel, Akron Early College, Akron East, Akron North, Cuyahoga Falls, Ellett Community Learning Center, Firestone Community Learning Center, Kenmore Garfield, National Inventors Hall of Fame STEM, Springfield, Stowe Monroe Falls, and Talmadge. Several weeks ago, teachers from each school received preview articles about the cases we are hearing, written by our public information staff at the court. The teachers worked with their students to understand the issues, and local attorneys offered instructional help. Summit County is served by the 9th District Court of Appeals, based here in Akron. I'd like to acknowledge the bench of the 9th District, Judge Lynn Callahan, Judge Donna Carr, Judge Jennifer Hensel, Judge Tom Theodosio, and Judge Betty Sutton. I wish to note that shared among these five appeal court judges are 4 Akron law degrees and 3 Akron undergraduate degrees. So once again, thank you to the entire Summit County community. To our audience and to our television and streaming viewers, welcome to this official session of the Supreme Court of Ohio. We begin with case 2019-1298, the State of Ohio versus Melvin Bourne. For the appellant, Mr. Van.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Van. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney from Cuyahoga County representing the State of Ohio. And I wouldn't like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The State of Ohio is here today to ask this court to reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals and to remand this matter to the trial court for further proceedings. It is the state's contention here that the appellee, Melvin Bourne, failed to demonstrate sufficient prejudice such that he would have satisfied the first prong of the actual prejudice test.
Mr. Van, what yes. prejudice would he have to manifest? What would he have to prove?
Well, in this case, we offered a few different things. And, really, when the state looked at this case, we've identified a few different flaws. First of all, with respect to the phone records, the state took issue with the limited testimony that was presented. When called to the stand, the investigator merely testified that he was tasked with determining when the cell phone provider went out of business. No other evidence was presented as far as investigative efforts to ascertain those records. And that's consistent with other decisions of the 8th District Court of Appeals, where the court had rejected claims of actual prejudice based on insufficient.
Is it the state's belief that Mr. Bourne's investigators or lawyers could have obtained phone records from the time of the alleged rape?
Well, Your Honor, it does seem with the passage of time, different phone providers keep records for only so long. We know that from practice. As far as call logs, but we don't have any sort of testimony as far as how long those records had been kept or what happened.
Well, if it's the state's belief that the records don't exist, or let's assume for the sake of argument, it's been too long and the phone records no longer exist, how then could Mr. Bourne show prejudice if his assertion was this was consensual, it was not rape, we called back and forth during that time, my phone records would prove that?
Well, here's the thing, Your Honor. By Mr. Bourne's own testimony, his story is that he had met the alleged victim on the street and that she had given him her phone number. By his own testimony, a friend was with him. During cross-examination, Mr. Bourne admitted that he knows his friend's name, and he had no reason to not know where his friend could be found. So there is a different witness who could testify to that event, and we haven't gotten to that stage. But I would also add, in this case, and many cases like it, when a defendant claims that there are cell phone records that would establish some sort of acquaintance or some timeline of events prior to the alleged sexual assault, in the state's view, that does not eliminate the state's prosecution because it does not go to the issue of consent. Acquaintance rape is a reality. We see cases all the time involving
But this wasn't acquaintance rape necessarily.
Or
right?
Even.
This is strange. I mean, if he met her on the street that day, this wasn't a longtime friend or someone she knew or family member or an old boyfriend.
Correct. And I was merely referring to the bigger picture here. But to that extent, and in context of this case, it still doesn't prove what happened in the alleged victim's home. Again, if we look at the defendant's testimony, he describes the act as consensual, and at the same time, he admits on the stand that someone walked in on this sexual act. We know from our investigation, it seems undisputed, the 8th District acknowledged the state's theory of the case, what's anticipated here, that this friend, an independent witness, not the alleged victim, would testify to the victim's state. And this case
Can I ask you a quick question? After this rape allegation was reported, was Mr. Bourne a known suspect to the police authorities?
No, Your Honor, he was not. And again, I think we can look first at Mr. Bourne's own testimony, in which he testified that the victim, alleged victim, really didn't know his name, indicated she probably only knew him as Mel because that's what was on his shirt when they allegedly met.
Doesn't Mr. Bourne claim that phone calls were made that caused him to return to the scene the next morning?
I don't recall if there were he claimed there were phone calls, but yes, so that part of the allegations was that Mr. Bourne had returned to the alleged victim's home, giving rise to a felonious assault report, and that's kind of where the report of the alleged sexual assault comes in. It comes in within this felonious assault report. So in that regard, and I think what's important here is that, you know, these are things that are appropriate for a jury to sort out as far as, you know, when we have two different stories, it's important. That's why juries are there, to sort out facts, to sort out any possible inconsistencies. And it's wholly still within the realm of possibility. Worst case scenario, even if the alleged victim was in contact with the defendant. Again, if the state's allegations are proven true, that the alleged victim was substantially impaired, any number of phone calls, and I'm talking about call logs, any evidence of phone calls before the alleged sexual assault or after the alleged sexual assault, that wouldn't diminish the state's prosecution substantially.
Your briefing states that you want us to clarify State v. Jones. You want, and throughout the briefing, that you use the term defendants making these pre-indictment delay claims should provide concrete evidence. How would we write such a rule? What if we believe you're correct?
Thinking about this, you know, part of the issues the state has had, and this begins with the line of cases, beginning with the crimes case. We had State versus Cafentera, State versus Willingham. It's the interpretation of paragraph 28 of Jones, which seems to have been applied in these cases, and it's certainly been argued by defendants that the assertion is enough. You know, because again, the court had indicated in Jones that the defendant need not prove or show precisely what would have come from the lost witness. So in many of these cases, it's been the assertion. And what's tricky and what's kind of troubling in cases such as this, and again, the state isn't necessarily asking for a specific rule in sexual assault cases. I think the courts have specifically, the 8th District in beginning of the crimes cases recognized that sexual assault cases are a credibility issue. And so we do see a lot of these pre-indictment delay claims now that are centered around credibility. And it's kind of frustrating for a state when we have claims that can't be proven either way. When a defendant says, hey, here's all these things that would have helped me, there's no verification on either side.
Okay, Mr. Phan, so what would need to have been shown here in order for the dismissal of this case based on pre-indictment to delay to have been sufficient in your mind?
In my mind, it's very difficult. It is a very high bar in this case. Again, based on the nature of the allegations, what's relevant is what occurred inside the victim's home.
So what would have been relevant enough here that the state would say, you know, yeah, that's right, that you wouldn't have appealed? You said there's got to be proof that the prejudice has to be shown. What would Mr. Bourne have had to have shown?
You know, I suppose in this case, again, based on the allegations, if perhaps the alleged victim's friend was unavailable, I mean, that certainly would hurt the state's case as well. And I think that's an important thing, because in this case it's a little different, because we do sort of have a direct witness to these alleged offenses. Typically, in sexual assault cases, we don't have that. But
so if Mr. Bourne said, "My phone records are unavailable. The victim's friend is unavailable. We've tried to find it, and my friend, who was allegedly with them that night, was unavailable." So he could not have access to any of that information, which would have supported, in his mind, his consent defense, then that would be enough to show prejudice.
Yeah, I would say that might be. And again, and the reason being is, especially where credibility is an issue, we do feel that, you know, that it's best to put these allegations before a jury, because juries are the fact finders, and they are the ones in our legal system responsible for making those factual determinations. I think any rule from this court would have to reflect that actual prejudice, to prove a due process violation, actual prejudice, a defendant needs to show more than a possibility of lost evidence that would be helpful. It needs to be.
Well, counsel, let me talk about the gap between the between the alleged rape and the arrest, the identification of Mr. Bourne and the arrest. How long was that?
I'm referring very quick. I believe it was about 12 years with the offense, alleged offense occurring in 2005. There was a CODIS hit in 2015 with the investigation and subsequent
2017
indictment.
Is when he was arrested, is that correct? 2005 to 17, something like that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You said there was a CODIS hit in 2015?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but he was in the system in 2005, was he not?
Yes, Ms. Bourne was previously in the CODIS database.
Okay, which is a little different from some of the other cases that we look at, because they weren't in the system until some other event triggered them going into the system, and then, you know, there was a hit after that. But here, the evidence could have been checked, and his identity would have been known immediately in 2005.
You know, certainly, Your Honor, and I think that's the thing. We've learned lots of lessons from our sexual assault kit initiative. We've learned the value of submitting every sexual assault case, not just the ones where there's an identifiable victim. We've also learned that it's important to even test the kits where it's a known suspect. So we have learned a lot, and that goes
to impossibility. Was it an impossibility in 2005 to process this rape kit?
Certainly the sexual assault kit could have been tested sooner. It did exist. It was something in existence. So yes,
it could have been tested any time during those 12 years. It could have been tested the next day. It could have been tested the next year.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, this sexual assault kit, like the many others, not just in Ohio, but across the country, could have been tested earlier. But again, these issues and these frustrations with the sexual assault kits that have sat for quite some time, these go to the reasons for delay, and certainly in every single case, there's always going to be different reasons. There's always different explanations. But in focusing on...
The reason for the delay here is the state didn't process it.
Yes, Your Honor.
It was the only entity that had to process it was the state, and it wasn't done.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You're into your... You have 2 minutes left, and you probably want to sit
Chief,
down.
Can I ask just one question?
Sure.
The defense's argument is really that these phone records were necessary to corroborate the defendant's story. What about the victim's phone records? Was there any effort? I mean, phone records typically go both ways, right? If I make a call, if I receive a call, it shows on my record as well as the person who sent it. Did the defense make any effort to get the victim's phone records?
There's no indication from the record that was done. And again, as I am out of time.
Out of time.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van. Mr. McCallum?
Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, and may it please the court. My name is Robert McCallum, and I represent the appellee, Mr. Melvin Bourne, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Public Defender. I'd like to start by quoting something the government said in its brief. There, the government said that the impact of its evidence will differ in every case because its evidence will differ in every case. And I think that's really why the reason why the government's anxiety about inconsistent results in this area is kind of unfounded or maybe even baseless. This is a highly fact-specific test. So something else that the government actually quotes the United States.
Let me ask you about that. This is, as you say, it's pretty fact-specific. So what? The only thing I see in the record that the defense did as far as the phone records was put on a investigator who said that the purported phone company the defendant used went out of business. Was there anything else in the record? Was there any attempt to locate the records, to see if records existed, to obtain the victim's records?
So there is something else in the record, and that's the defendant's testimony in front of the trial court under oath. He gave about 15, 20 pages of testimony on direct examination. He was subjected to about 25 minutes.
But what about the phone records? I mean, the gist of your case seems to be that the inability to get these phone records has prejudiced the defendant. So, what is in the record about what the defense did to try to obtain these phone records?
So, there is the investigator's testimony. There's Mr. Bourne's testimony.
What does it say? I mean, all I see is one statement that says essentially the phone company went out of business. Is there anything else?
No, I think that's it. In terms of the direct investigation, I'm sorry.
Did you try to get the victim's records?
Not to my knowledge, but
wouldn't that have been equally probative on the phone record issue as the defendants?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably would have been helpful information, but it ultimately the trial court.
Wouldn't they have shown this? I mean, if what your client says is true, wouldn't they have shown the exact same thing as the defendant's phone records?
I think that's likely.
Mr. McCallum.
So why not try to get them?
So, I don't want to speak to the investigator's investigation, but I do think, in like his specific investigative techniques, but I think the important thing here is that what was presented was enough to satisfy the trial court. I mean, I don't think this particular trial court or any trial court is going to take this matter lightly. I don't think they're also going to be likely to be viewing the defendant kind of sympathetically at the outset.
Well, Mr. McCallum,
before you go further in the test or analysis, what difference would it have made in this case if the alleged victim was impaired, even if there was a phone exchange between them, even if it was an acquaintance situation, if she were impaired and or unconscious, what difference would this evidence make to the charge, to the offense?
Well, I think what it could have done is it could have minimized. This evidence doesn't need to eliminate the impact of the government's case. It needs to at least minimize it. And so I think what it could have done, it could have been used to impeach her credibility in any number of matters. And so I think, you know, it satisfies the test in that it does not have to be exculpatory. It just has to be useful.
Let's talk about that. How does the Eighth District and the trial court noted that the closing of the bar was a factor? Mm-hmm. How does closing the bar tell me whether the victim consented or not?
Well, so, I mean, that's, I think, one factor among several. In and of itself, that would probably not be satisfactory. That wouldn't be sufficient.
Well, let's then talk about the demolishing of the house. How does that tell me whether the victim consented or not?
So the alleged victim claims that there was, or she suggests anyway, that there was a forced entry. So the destruction of the house would make it difficult or impossible to see if there are signs of that, particularly when combined with other evidence. You know, that's the thing here, is each of these pieces of evidence relates to other pieces of evidence in the case, and there are...
It's a cumulative, your argument is a cumulative argument.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it has to be, because in order, I mean, the question is just, you know, is there missing or unavailable evidence that that would minimize the impact? And it's not just this, but it would it minimize or eliminate the impact of the government's evidence?
Is the standard actual prejudice?
The standard is actual prejudice. And Justice Brunner, I feel like I just have to say yes.
Okay, so I want to go back to the phone records. And the question earlier asked to you by Justice DeWine was, wouldn't you get the same information from the victim's phone records? But is it possible, I mean, since this phone company went out of business, that these were just like phones where you buy the number of minutes and they're throwaway phones and he might not even remember his phone number? I mean, are we dealing with that potential situation?
Yeah.
Because in middle class life and above, we all... everybody carries their same phone number from the, you know, for 20 years because the phone company started doing that. But if it's not that kind of a phone, it's possible he wouldn't even remember his phone number, correct?
I think that's possible, yeah. I think that's absolutely possible.
Was he asked if anyone remembered his phone number?
He was not, so, but...
It was your burden to put on that evidence, right?
It was our burden to show that there was some actual prejudice, yeah. And ultimately, it was the trial court's determination that there was, because this is such a fact-specific test. So something the government quotes the United States Supreme Court in the Lovasco case, saying that it's almost impossible to imagine a set of circumstances in the abstract that would or would not require dismissal in this area, because it just depends on a million different factors. I mean, it's
counsel,
possible...
They're getting back to the phone records, which seems to be the only thing that anybody can hang their hat on here. I think we're all agreeing that the closing of the bar, the destroying of the house, you know, that's kind of a dead end when it comes to presenting evidence that would be probative. But was there any testimony that not only did Revel?
I'm not actually sure how it's pronounced.
Okay, the phone company go out of business, but their records are unavailable. I mean, the testimony was only that they went out of business in 2005, right?
And that the investigator was unable to obtain any records.
Okay,
from
but
them, so.
Unable to obtain doesn't say I tried to do it, right? There's no testimony that I contacted, you know, their agents or anybody representing them, and their records are in the wind.
Yeah, I that's correct.
Okay, but so would you agree that just saying they went out of business is insufficient?
Well, I think that the investigation could have been more thorough. I think that's probably the case, honestly, on both sides of this case, and I think it's the case in almost any case. I mean, they could have dug deeper, more stones could have been flipped over.
Well, but, I mean, some preliminary stones haven't even been touched. That's my problem here. You know, I don't think you can say categorically every investigation can be done better, because there's some investigations that are both by the state and by the defense in cases that are thorough and convincing and you know, bring evidence, like corroborated evidence forward.
Mr. McCaleb, was there the loss of the investigative file? Is that a prejudice to your client, and if so, how?
So yes, I think it is, and or the unavailability of the file. I mean, as far as can really be seen here, that almost no work was done to initially investigate this case.
And we're talking about the 2005 file, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Right. Of course, we have the 2017 investigative file, but the material that was compiled, whatever it consisted of in 2005, is also missing. One of the few people who interacted with any aspect of this case during the period between the CODIS hit and the ultimate indictment has passed away. Now, he wasn't a direct investigator. He found the forensic evidence recovery kit abandoned in some locker and did talk to the sex crimes unit and a couple of other units in the police department to try to find something about the case.
Counsel, we may disagree with the trial court judge that you met your burden, but is that our job to second guess the trial court judge. Don't they have the discretion to see whether the first prong was satisfied? Then they would move on to the second prong.
Yes, honestly, I do agree. And I think, you know, the government itself, during its argument, emphasized the importance of fact finders. And a lot of the stuff here, you know, it doesn't make it necessarily into the transcript. It's not just the words that go into the transcript, although those are, of course, important. But it's things like that fact finders, including trial courts, including juries, including just ordinary people, all of us in our day-to-day lives, make decisions about who's telling the truth about things based on things like the tilt of someone's head, the shifting of their eyes, the sweatiness.
So in that vein, if you look at United States v. Marion, which I guess is the leading case on this, or the first case anyway, from the U.S. Supreme Court, what the court there said is, you know, let this go to trial, and it may be that at the end of trial it's appropriate to move to dismiss because of pre-indictment delay, but there's not enough showing as a preliminary matter. Why is that not the case here? If it goes to trial and there really is shown that the defendant is prejudiced by pre-indictment delay, then the defense can move to dismiss the case. But for all those reasons you mentioned about trials, why not let that happen first?
Well, I think because it can violate your constitutional rights to be put on trial when evidence has.
I don't think that's right. I mean, because the court said the opposite in United States v. Marion. They said it was so you can be put on trial, and you can move at the end.
And I think there are circumstances in which you can be put on trial. But I think when the trial court is making this preliminary determination that it is simply not possible for there to be a fair trial because you're being subjected to this process where, you know, you can't actually offer any defense. You might have once been able to, but you can't anymore. I think that ultimately is a grave constitutional concern and is appropriately resolved by the trial courts in this area by looking at because it's not just, you know, the government suggests that people can just kind of come in and make up these claims. And I think it's true that anyone can just make up a claim of missing evidence.
Counsel, but there's nothing more here than your client's testimony. There's little else.
And in that testimony, was there a proffer of what these phone conversations said? Or was it just, does your client want to just say that, look at all these back and forth calls, which shows it wasn't a stranger rape situation, or was there a proffer?
Well, it was a little bit of both. I mean, there's not an enormous amount of detail because, of course, it's been 12 years. That's part of the problem here, too. But it wasn't also just like, oh, well, I'm pretty sure that we had a couple of conversations. And to your question, Chief Justice O'Connor, I think, yes, that is the sort of the core of this case is my client's testimony in front of the trial court, but that's the core of every case, is people's testimony in court, and it's believed or it's disbelieved.
Right, but because of these pre-indictment delay cases, because the state took a long time to process a lot of rape kits over the years, you do have this sense of there might be evidence that's missing, but for the victims, say, don't we have to balance, you know, the victim's right to justice and the state's right to prosecute here? Neither you, Mr. Van, anybody who's currently involved with this case now had anything to do with the 2005, you know, botched investigation or failure to investigate or test the kits. So why isn't it better to balance here? Because as you suggest, anyone can come in and say, oh, that's been 12 years. Well, let me see. The bar's closed. The house is torn down. I didn't have facial hair then. There's no, you know, just a whole bunch of things you can throw up against the wall and then see what sticks.
Well, so I think I want to be clear. I think it's possible for anyone to make up claims of missing evidence, but it's very hard to make them up and then have them be believed because you're being subjected to a cross-examination. You're in front of a judge who's intimately familiar with this sort of thing. I mean, I could make up case law standing up here right now. That'd be pretty easy, but it would be very hard for, you know, it would very quickly become clear that I had done that under this court's close questioning. And so it's sort of, you know, that's what's ultimately happening here.
So doesn't that counsel for letting it go to trial then?
I think it counsels to letting it be decided by a fact finder, because here, the, you know, the purpose of this question here is not guilt. It's not, did this happen beyond a reasonable doubt?
Let me go back to something you said before. You said that he testified that he couldn't find the records. I just went back, and I can't find that testimony. The only testimony I find from the investigator is, can you describe for the court what was the matter that you were asked to investigate? To look into the Revel phone to see when they went out of business. I believe that was. And I discovered it was, I want to say, maybe 2005. They went out of business. That was it. That's all your investigator testified to. He didn't testify about anything about the records you're trying to get him, did he?
Yeah, so, no. And I mean, obviously I see I'm out of time, if I may answer.
You can answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, no. And could that have been more closely investigated? Of course. Absolutely. Should there maybe have been something else that the investigator could have done? Yes. But ultimately what happened here is the trial court believed Mr. Bourne's claims. And that's what the test asks trial courts to do, to balance the evidence that was available at the time against the currently available evidence and whatever it believes about what evidence has been missing.
There's really no evidence that this evidence was unavailable other than the company went out of business, right? We know nothing about whether any records were retained, whether that evidence could have been obtained from her. That's just not there, is it?
I think we know that the trial court believed that that evidence was missing. And I think then ultimately that's sufficient for satisfying this test. And for those reasons, I would urge this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van, you may take a minute.
Mr. Van, before you start quickly, do you know if there's any way to get cell phone records once a mobile provider has been closed?
I do think it would come to a matter of every business's practices as far as what business records were transferred over, terms of purchases.
And was the investigator cross-examined on that? When he said, I checked into it, the store is closed, was there a cross-examination, a question of whether there was a way to secure these records otherwise?
No, Your Honor. And if we also look at page 76 of the transcript, the investigator also indicates he was not even given a phone number to look into. And I do want to turn to one thing, maybe two things that opposing counsel mentioned. First, he indicated that this case is really fact-specific, as with all pre-indictment delay claims. But cases like this one, cases like Caffin Terrace, you know, we thought Caffin Terrace was really specific to its facts as far as what the defendant was trying to show in that case as far as actual prejudice. Yet it was cited, you know, again and again, relied upon by defense counsel, and accepted in this case as being the basis for a dismissal. So I do think we have something right here. And I do think one thing that we can look into is what my opposing counsel indicated. The word minimize, that comes from paragraph 28 of Jones. You know, the evidence has to eliminate or minimize the state's evidence. You know, eliminate's pretty clear. To me, minimize is more than, you know, just a possibility, more than, you know, like with probative value, it's more than just a little bit. It has to do significant damage to the state's theory of the case. And I think that's one point where we can clarify the decision in Jones.
Even if we use that language, it has to do significant, that's still going to be in the mind of the fact finder, the judge hearing the case.
That is true, but on the level of appellate review, and I think different courts have cited different standards. You know, if we take the mixed standard, any fact findings of the trial court has to be supported by credible evidence. There's no credible evidence here that evidence was lost. As far as the law to facts, that's de novo. So yes, we do need a standard. That's something that appellate courts can use in the future to apply to trial courts. Findings or determination of actual
counsel
prejudice.
In your briefs, you use a lot of the phrase substantial prejudice repeatedly.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it the standard actual prejudice, and you're asking us to develop Jones beyond what Jones stands for?
Well, and again, I think that goes back to when I'm reading, you know, all these cases that have been decided by the Court of Appeals since Jones. You know, actual prejudice to me sounds pretty strong, and I agree, maybe actual and substantial are synonymous, but where I read cases, and it looks and appears to me that courts are finding actual prejudice just on the possibility, just the slight possibility that prejudice might exist. That's what the state has a problem with, and that's why the state is asking the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to remand this matter to the trial court for further proceedings against this victim, Jane Doe 2.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.